And we're back. Welcome to this week's episode of Until Green Card Do Us Part, a weekly show where we address the issues that immigration-based marriages made a few feet short of heaven create for American citizens and their families. I'm your host, John Sampson, CEO of CSI Consulting. Ladies and gentlemen, I am pissed off. I am highly pissed off. And at the conclusion of this episode and next week's episode, I would venture a guess everybody listening to this show will be equally pissed off. Last week, we began to look at the biases and prejudices, both political and ideological, of judges, attorneys, pro-immigrant rights groups, and others who were involved in immigration-related matters directly affecting American citizens. We also raised the issue of bias within USCIS as well. This week, we're going to expand on what is an alarming situation within USCIS upper management involving corruption, misfeasance, malfeasance, and nonfeasance. A culture of corruption that has been in place for quite some time in USCIS, perhaps going as far back as to when it was formed on March 1st, 2003. The corruption I speak of and what Michael J. Maxwell testified to in 2006 has been in place for 18 years. In preparing for this week's show, I reviewed the congressional testimony of Michael J. Maxwell, the former director of the Office of Security and Investigations, or OSI, the Internal Affairs Unit within USCIS. Most of this episode will feature Mr. Maxwell's actual testimony presented to Congress. However, before we get into this, understand, the vast majority of USCIS employees are hardworking, principled, dedicated men and women who want to do the job the American people want them to do, which is to protect the United States. Unfortunately, however, there are some who don't give a damn about what's best for the United States or its people. And what makes it worse is that many of those are in positions of power and influence within USCIS. Mr. Maxwell has testified before Congress on numerous occasions during his brief time at OSI and after he was forced out by USCIS upper management. We'll be looking at his congressional testimony in April and July of 2006, after he had been forced to retire, or not retire, but resign out of utter frustration. His testimony stands as a scathing indictment against USCIS upper management. Keep in mind, his testimony was given while George W. Bush was president. This was before Barack Obama, before Donald Trump, and before Joe Biden. This issue will be the subject of two or more episodes. We will start with Maxwell's April 2006 testimony in this episode and conclude with his July 2006 testimony in later episodes. It's that important. You need to pay attention because it outlines the entire problem this country is facing with its immigration system, to include all the fraud that goes on in marriage fraud, U visa fraud, T visa fraud, and the Violence Against Women Act provisions of the immigration law. Once you hear what Maxwell had to say to Congress, you will be left with no other choice but to conclude our entire immigration system has been corrupted to the core and needs to be scrapped and replaced with the system that emphasizes national security, public safety, public health, and economic security, and not a system that emphasizes family reunification. Last week, I raised the question, is coming to the United States as an immigrant and remaining in the United States as an immigrant a right or a privilege? The law says it's a privilege. However, as I said last week, there are those among us, some in upper echelons of USCIS that you will see, who believe coming to America as an immigrant is somehow a right. The problem is that those organizations who benefit from this corruption will fight tooth and nail to ensure the corrupt system remains in effect, thereby putting this country's national security, public safety, public health, and economy at grave risk. So let's get started. OSI started up in early 2004, and Maxwell was forced to resign in February of 2006 out of frustration. In short, he was running OSI for 2 years, and as you will see, was stymied by the entrenched immigrants first mentality of USCIS upper management, U.S. citizens and national security, public health and safety, and economic security be damned. OSI's mandate from then-director Eduardo Aguirre, a George Bush appointee, was to, quote, regain the public trust in the immigration service, unquote, by identifying, reporting, and resolving any security vulnerabilities that would permit the successful manipulation of the immigration system by either external or internal agents. Director Aguirre authorized in writing the immediate hiring of 45 new personnel for OSI, including 23 criminal investigators, to investigate allegations of employee corruption and wrongdoing. Maxwell testified that by May of 2005, he had been authorized a staffing level of 130 full-time employees and contract workers. His only option for bringing staff on board, however, was to transfer them laterally from other DHS components because the Human Capital Office of Administration refused to post any new vacancy announcement, apparently because they did not approve of a law enforcement component within USCIS. Let that sink in for just a moment. In August of 2005, not long after the departure of Director Aguirre, his staffing matrix was effectively cut from 130 to fewer than 50 personnel worldwide. USCIS senior leadership, as represented on the Senior Review Board, which must approve all significant expenditures, as well as the Human Capital Office of Administration, you know, those folks who didn't want a law enforcement presence in USCIS, blatantly disregarded the written orders of former Director Aguirre and unilaterally decided that OSI should not be adequately staffed. The same senior leaders who had absolutely refused to allow OSI to obtain the necessary resources to fulfill its mission also refused time and time again to act when confronted with major national security vulnerabilities his team and he identified in the immigration process. Each of the security breaches described below was brought immediately by Maxwell to the attention of top-level officials at USCIS. We'll start with internal affairs. OSI received 2,271 complaints about employee misconduct between August 2004 and October of 2005. To be fair, 80% of the complaints were made by applicants complaining their applications were not adjudicated in a timely manner. However, almost 20% of them, 528 of the 2,771, alleged criminal activities. Alleged crimes include bribery, harboring illegal aliens, money laundering, sale of documents, marriage fraud, extortion, undue foreign influence, and making false statements, among other things. Also included among these complaints are national security cases. For example, allegations of USCIS employees providing material support to known terrorists or being influenced by foreign intelligence services. In an effort to keep this show family friendly, I'm going to drop the, expletive. But I have to ask the question, are you effing kidding me? Complaints with clear national security implications represent a small share of the total. But in cases such as these, even one is too many. Written allegations set forth by USCIS employees, interviews conducted as recently as the day before Maxwell testified, with USCIS line employees and high-level managers, internal USCIS communications, and external investigative documents prepared by independent third agencies, compiled and delivered to this Congress over the last 8 months, make clear that the integrity of the United States immigration system has been corrupted and the system is incapable of ensuring the security of our homeland. We're going to get into an area called TECS, which is the Treasury Enforcement Computer System. It is a database that is maintained by Customs and Border Protection. It has four levels of access, 1, 2, 3, and 4, one being the lowest, 4 being the highest. And in order to get level 3 or 4 access, you have to have a full security background investigation or an SBI. Maxwell goes into cases involving USCIS employees who had given unauthorized access to texts to relatives, friends, and non-USCIS employees. He stated he was prevented by upper USCIS management from investigating these allegations. Maxwell testified. More alarming, he said, however, is an allegation that has not yet been investigated, in which a Chinese-born U.S. citizen who works for USCIS permitted a family member to access text, print records from it, and then leave the building with those records. We do not know what records this person accessed or why. And yet, this allegation is not being investigated because OSI's criminal investigators are stretched beyond their limits. Consider for a moment the potential repercussions of these types of investigations. One USCIS employee co-opted by a foreign intelligence entity with the ability to grant the immigration status of their choosing to the person or persons of their choosing at the time and location of their choosing. This threat represents a clear and ongoing danger to the national security of the United States. The possibilities, are even worse when you consider the nexus that this subcommittee knows to exist between countries with highly capable intelligence services and state sponsors of terrorism. Again, I ask the question, are you kidding me? And if that wasn't bad enough, Maxwell went on to outline another text-related issue, which is insufficient text access for USCIS employees. As I said earlier, there are four levels of text access, and unfortunately, USCIS employees only have access to the first, possibly two levels, and lack access to levels 3 and 4. Level 3 access would allow USCIS adjudicators access to not only USCIS, CBP, and ICE records, as well as NCIC and other criminal databases to a limited extent, but also national security and terrorist watch lists, threats to public safety, and information about ongoing investigations. Now, one would think that that would be something a USCIS adjudicator would need to know before they adjudicated an application for a benefit under the immigration laws. Clearly, USCIS employees need access to the level 3 records in order to properly vet applicants for immigration status and/or documents and ensure that known terrorists and others who present the threat to national security or public safety are not able to game the immigration system. On the other hand, however, because of the sensitive nature of some of these records, including ongoing national security cases, it's important that access to Level 3 records be restricted to employees who themselves have been thoroughly vetted. That kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Thus, when DHS was created in January of 2003, CBP, as the manager of TECS, entered into an agreement with USCIS that requires employees to undergo full background investigations, or SBIs, before they may be granted Level 3 TECS access. The agreement included a 2-year grandfather period during which legacy Immigration and Naturalization Service, or INS, personnel who had access to Level 3 TECS records previously at the INS would continue to have access so that USCIS would have time to complete SBIs on new employees and upgrade those SBIs on legacy employees when necessary. USCIS leadership, however, decided not to spend the money to require full SBIs on new personnel or to upgrade the SBIs on legacy personnel. Thus, when the grandfather period ended in January of 2005, CBP began restricting access by USCIS employees with only limited background investigations so that these employees can access only Level 1 USCIS records, or in some cases, Level 2 records through TECS. They could not access the national security, public safety, or terrorist records they need to process applications. Other than a few sporadic meetings among USCIS senior staff and once in a while with some CBP officials to talk about how many employees might have restricted access, USCIS leadership largely ignored the problem during the first 9 months of 2005, despite complaints from the field and warnings from within headquarters. Backlog elimination was the top priority of the agency, so employees were pressured to keep pumping out the applications, regardless of whether they had the ability to determine if an applicant was a known terrorist or presented some other threat to national security or public safety. Again, I ask, are you kidding me? In early October 2005, the problem drew congressional and media attention. Imagine that. The Public Affairs Office assured reporters that employees having access to the records they need, while Acting Deputy Director Robert Devine, more about Mr. Devine in a little bit, who was Chief of Staff Tom Parr and Don Crescetti, the Director of the Fraud Detection and National Security, or FDNS, office, were frantically trying to figure out the difference between Level 2 and Level 3 TECS records in order to determine what critical information employees were missing. You can't make this stuff up, boys and girls. You really can't. During a late night meeting in the second week of October 2005, Crescetti acknowledged that Level 2 access leaves employees completely blind to sensitive national security, public safety, and terrorist records, along with information about ongoing investigations. Deputy Director of Domestic Operations Janice Posato told the group that 80% of all applications are processed through TECS at Level 3 as part of an automated background check system. She noted that some unknown portion of the remaining 20% are processed by the more than 1,700 employees with only Level 2 or below access. So critical national security indicators may have been missed. Hang on to your chairs, boys and girls. Buckle up, because here it comes, the justification for all of this. ADD Robert Devine's response to this information was, and I quote, "I guess we finally reached that point. Is immigration a right or a privilege?" In the ensuing debate, to which Maxwell was a party to, Devine and Acting General Counsel Dia Carpenter insisted that immigration to the United States is a right and not a privilege. Before coming to work for USCIS, Mr. Devine was the American Immigration Lawyers Association chapter chairman in Tennessee and a member of AILA since 1986. Let me draw the diagram that is needed to be drawn here. By allowing Mr. Devine to reach the level of influence within USCIS that the Bush administration allowed would be the same as if the chapter president of the ACLU in Tennessee were to be appointed attorney general. It brings an entirely new meaning to that old phrase, letting the fox into the hen house. Given that the law, you know, that inconvenient truth, as Al Gore was fond of saying, says it's a privilege, you gotta wonder how Devine and Carpenter were able to get away with this ideological departure from the law. Which leads us into the next category, irresponsible policies. Information from various sources indicate that criminals and potentially terrorists are being granted immigration status and or documents or being permitted to remain in the United States illegally through a variety of irresponsible policy decisions by USCIS leadership, the consequences of which they are well aware. We start with background checks on aliens, USCIS Operation Instruction 105.10. Instructs employees that, quote, if no response is received to an FBI or CIA name check request within 40 days of the date of mailing the request card, the application or petition shall be processed on the assumption that the results of the request are negative. Moreover, Maxwell was told as recently as 3 weeks before he testified that USCIS district offices and service centers are, get this, hold on, holding competitions and offering a variety of rewards, including cash bonuses, time off, movie tickets, and gift certificates to employees and or teams of employees with the fastest processing times. Are you effing kidding me? The quality of processing is not a factor. Only the quantity of closed applications matters. And it is important to note that it takes a lot less time to approve an application than to deny one, since denials require written justifications and often results in appeals. Moving on to fingerprint checks on applications for U.S. citizenship. OSI was notified that employees were not following DHS regulations that prohibit a naturalization exam from being scheduled before the fingerprint check results are returned by the FBI. This is a critical problem because there is a statutory or legal 120-day window after the naturalization exam during which a final decision on the application for citizenship must be made. If a decision is not made during that window, for whatever the reason, good, bad, or indifferent, the alien may petition a court for a writ of mandamus, which orders USCIS to decide the application immediately. When Maxwell approached Acting Deputy Director Devine about this issue, Devine indicated that he was aware of the problem. He said that as chief counsel, he had discussed this issue numerous times with USCIS senior staff, including then Director of Domestic Operations, Bill Yates. Devine said he had concluded on his own that since the fingerprint results come back before the 120-day window closes in 80% of the cases, well, the other 20% represent an acceptable risk. His words, not mine. Moving on to employment authorization documents. A USCIS regulation, HCFR 274A.13, states that if an application for adjustment to lawful permanent resident status is not adjudicated within 90 days, the applicant is entitled to file an I-765 application for employment authorization. This policy, Maxwell said, has led to large-scale fraud. Imagine that. The current processing times, keep in mind this was in testimony in 2005, it's gotten worse since then, by the way, for an application for legal permanent resident status range from just under 6 months to 60 months at the four servicing processing centers and from 6 months to 33 months at the larger district offices. So virtually all applicants, whether they are eligible or not, and whether they are lawfully present in the United States or not, are able to obtain a legitimate EAD or employment authorization document under this policy. Illegal aliens can simply file a fraudulent application for permanent residence, wait 90 days, knowing full well and good they're not going to get an answer on their application, and then ask for an employment authorization document. Once they have the EAD, they can apply for a legitimate Social Security number, and even under the Real ID Act, they can legally obtain a driver's license because they have an application for permanent resident status pending. With the Social Security number and a driver's license, they can get a job and fill out a 9-9 employment eligibility verification form. According to the Government Accountability Office, or the GAO, we heard about them last week, an estimated 23,000 aliens were granted EADs on the basis of fraudulent applications for permanent resident status between 2000 and 2004. When asked by the GAO to comment on the fraud resulting from this policy, USCIS leadership indicated that fairness to legitimate applicants outweighs the need to close security loopholes. Are you getting the picture here? We have more coming next week, boys and girls, and it only gets worse. But at this point, we've run out of time for this week's show. We will pick up where we left off with more of Mr. Maxwell's testimony before Congress, and you should be getting the picture right about now that USCIS upper management is not particularly concerned about fraud and or national security. They are concerned about maintaining a friendly customer service-oriented atmosphere where service provided to immigrants supersedes our national interests. Until next week, I'm your host, John Sampson. Thanks for listening.